We've been reflecting on Women's Health Week all week long here. We've been hearing different stories, women talking about the impacts on health, financial, paternity leave. We've been talking about a myriad of issues as it relates to women. And today we're talking about alternative pathways to motherhood. So what do you do when you want to be a mother, but the road there is not so straightforward? According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, infertility affects about 7.3 million women and their partners in the U.S. It's about 12% of the reproductive age population. So today we speak with mothers who have taken an alternative pathway to motherhood and a fertility physician who offers medical options for people who want to become parents. Seattle reproductive medicine fertility physician Angela Thayer joins us in the studio, as does mother Jennifer Lair. Angela and Jennifer, both welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jennifer, I'm going to start with you. You have had numerous pregnancy losses, mm-hmm. and you have used fertility treatments, and you're sitting here today with your cute little boy here, as well as another one on the way. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
But talk about your path to motherhood.
Well, it started very similar to most people who come across issues, and that is we tried for well over a year to try to get pregnant and finally did some testing and found out that it was basically impossible, less than one in a million chance of getting pregnant naturally. And so we waived our alternatives on what route we chose to go with. And we did a lot of research on IVF. We did a lot of research on adoption. And we thought at the time, let's try IVF to have a natural birth first, or natural child first. And if that didn't work out for us, then we would definitely go the adoption route.
I'm glad you mentioned the adoption, because I think that's always a question that comes up when people talk about people wanting to have a kid and mm-hmm. wanting to have a kid naturally. And there is always that alternative, because there are so many kids who need really good homes. And I was curious, I was going to ask you, like, how do you respond to that? Because some people, there are arguments that people say, well, that's just selfish. If you can't have a kid, you should just adopt, because there are plenty of kids already in the world. Why create your own? So how do you respond to that kind of reaction?
Well, I have never had that conversation approached to me, luckily.
Yes.
But I think in our sense, I think everybody wants to have their own child, their own blood child, you know, that they've created. But, you know, so it was just our decision to go that route to begin with. We luckily had some insurance coverage for it as well, and that helped to make our decision up front to go with the IVF. It was a little bit less expensive for us than the adoption route, but we definitely have never pushed the adoption route aside. You know, that's always been an option if it didn't work out with IVF. And
well,
we've just been lucky enough that it has.
Say, luckily it did.
Yes.
Again, congratulations.
Thank you.
But how many times did you have to go through treatment before? Because I noted that you have had several miscarriages mm-hmm. as well. Was that from the IVF treatment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
we've had, this is our fourth IVF session. And so obviously it's child number two. And we've lost a total of five embryos, you know. We started out with twins every time. My son was a twin when we started with him, and we lost his twin early on. And it's a risk you take with IVF. That, you know, there's no guarantee, and it's really an anomaly to why I had actually miscarried, because our fertility issues are actually with my husband. So it was kind of we had challenges on both sides. And
talk about some of those fertility issues, because I did get some information that it was a genetic makeup issue.
And well, just with my husband. I mean, that's just how he was made. You know, he just doesn't produce, and he doesn't produce quantity and quality, I guess, is if that's the right terminology.
We're looking at Angela. Angela, maybe this is when I should bring you in. You're the physician in the room. Can you kind of just kind of expand a little bit on what she's talking about in terms of, you know, the genetic makeup and the maybe quality, quantity issue of not being able?
Well, yeah, I think when we're looking at sperm and a semen analysis, we evaluate the quantity, the concentration, the motility, and the morphology, which is the shape of the sperm. And in some men, the count or the motility is so low that it's really going to lead somebody to need IVF as probably their only chance for a baby. sometimes men will have some milder issues in those parameters, which will allow them to conceive with an IUI, which is an intrauterine insemination, where we're just able to wash and process the sperm and put it directly into the uterus. But male factor infertility or sperm issues makes up about 30% of infertility.
And what are some of the issues as it relates to women on the other side of that spectrum?
So for women, some women don't ovulate regularly. So polycystic ovary syndrome, something like endometriosis, pelvic adhesions, fibroids or scarring in the uterus, and just age has an overall impact on the ability of a woman to conceive.
And talk about some of the other methods. I mean, we've heard Jennifer, they went with the in vitro, but what are some other alternatives to motherhood for women who are wanting to conceive and or look at other options to be able to have a child?
Well, a lot of times when a woman or a couple comes in, we do all the basic testing. So we look at the ovulation pattern, we check progesterone, we check the fallopian tube status, we check the sperm, we check what's called the ovarian reserve, which is kind of a rough indicator of the egg supply to say, hey, at 35, do you have an average number of eggs, more eggs than usual, fewer eggs? Because if a woman is 35 and has fewer eggs, then she's probably going to run into some issues with quality of her eggs if those eggs are running out. And so we do all that testing, and then we talk about different treatment options. And so early on, one of the treatment options we talk about, a lot of people take entry-level fertility medications to basically help them to either ovulate regularly and release one egg on a regular basis, or take the medications to ovulate more than one egg. So if they might ovulate two eggs a month, if we're concerned that the quality of those eggs might not be as good and they might be at risk for reproductive losses, and recognizing that not every egg or embryo will eventually result in a live birth, we try to increase the success rate by increase the number of eggs. And then, you know, obviously combine that with either intercourse or the artificial insemination, depending on if there may also be a sperm issue.
And what is the, I guess, kind of the success rate, you know, when people do come in and they kind of go through, you know, let's say like the treatment that Jennifer went through, she said you had what, this is your fourth, and so you've had
this is our
two.
Fourth. We lost two full pregnancies. And the first one we lost, the second one, my son, we were lucky with my son. And then the third one we lost, and then this one we conceived.
So how does Jennifer's kind of path compare to the path of women that are coming in seeking this kind of treatment?
Yeah, that could be pretty typical. You know, a lot of couples, it's very age-based, and when somebody's looking at success rates, some of the entry-level treatments aren't going to be as successful as IVF, ultimately. But something might have a success rate of 10 to 20% with the fertility drugs and the insemination, moving up to something like in vitro, which is much more advanced technologically, and we're using more eggs, so we're creating more potential opportunities for success. The success rate could be as high as 60% for a young woman, and then it drops off as women get older. So somebody who's 40 who tries IVF, her success rate may only be 20 to 30%.
Well, talk about fertility preservation, because I know that's another option, and kind of explain a little bit about that.
Well, the egg freezing technology has really just exploded in its efficacy and its ability to provide opportunity in the past 5 years. And last year, our national organization, American Society for Reproductive Medicine, changed the classification for egg freezing from an experimental procedure to not experimental anymore, because people have been freezing eggs now long enough and using them to create pregnancies that we're seeing very good success rates.
Does that impact insurance then in any way? Or what is the change of status? you know, how does that impact a couple or, you know, coming in wanting to use that?
Right. Well, we are trying. That's a process that takes some time. So there's always some catch up. We're working with some of the major insurance carriers that already have infertility benefits to tell them that because this is no longer an experimental procedure, it's a great benefit to women, and we hope they cover it. There are a lot of women who maybe are still single, haven't met the right partner, who decide at 30 or 35 they might want to use some money or a benefit to preserve their own future fertility and go through basically the first half of an IVF cycle to freeze some eggs that could present that future opportunity if they delay their own fertility for 5 to 10 years. And on the other side, I've seen couples come in who maybe have gotten a later start. So maybe they're starting their family at 35 or 40 and they know they want more than one child. So they're actually interested in what we call embryo banking, where they'll plan on doing back-to-back IVF cycles with the goal of maybe doing one or two cycles where they just freeze embryos. And then they don't use those right away. They're going to hold those for a couple years. And then they go right into a second IVF cycle. But with that cycle, they're going to transfer embryos with the hope of getting pregnant, carrying to term, delivering, and then come back in a couple years and use the ones they froze the first time around.
Well, talk about the role of integrated medicine, because I know that a lot of people who seek those kind of treatments also kind of use some other homeopathic or natural methods, if you will, kind of in conjunction. And I see Jennifer shaking her head, so maybe I'll come to you on that question first. Did you use any integrated medicine? And if so, kind of talk about what you did use.
Acupuncture. I'm a big acupuncture person, and I always did acupuncture before and after, actually, in leading up to the transfer.
Hmm. Yeah, we definitely support the use of a lot of acupuncture, especially through all treatment types that we do, from the entry level all the way up through IVF. A lot of our patients also use acupuncture before, during, and after the treatment. And, you know, we have an acupuncturist on staff. So if somebody's been using acupuncture in their community and they want acupuncture immediately after an embryo transfer within 30 minutes before and after, we arrange that. We also have some women follow traditional Chinese medicine, which we, you know, say is fine at the beginning. Usually if somebody's doing in vitro, we ask them to stop that. We want to avoid any interactions that might occur. But we also use supportive vitamins, supplements, nutritional therapy, support groups to just deal with the stress and anxiety that comes with everybody having to go through all these treatments.
Well, speaking of the support factor, I wanted to turn to you, Jennifer, and just kind of talk to you about what message you might give to people who are in a similar scenario like yourself and maybe seeking an alternative pathway to motherhood.
Well, support systems are huge. You got to have a support system, and that's something that's not really out there that much. I think people are really embarrassed sometimes to talk about their situation because they feel like it's wrong or something's wrong with them. And it's a very isolating and alone process that I think the women feel when they go through it. And you feel isolated. The couple can feel isolated in just having some infertility issues because it's not a big thing that we talk about in our society. Society doesn't look at it as an open topic as cancer or other issues that people may have, and those are pretty major, but it's something that is definitely not addressed and talked about very much.
And speaking of not talking about it, you know, you saying that kind of made me think of another question in terms of reactions. Did you get people reacting to you like, oh, poor Jennifer, she can't have a baby? And I mean, you know, if you were discussing it all, I mean, what kind of reactions did you get? Because I know I've heard that from other people who've been through that process where there is kind of this stigma and this little bit of taboo, like, oh, poor you, mm-hmm. something is wrong with you. And like you said, that is isolating. I can't imagine how you react to that.
Right. Well, a lot of people, when we would tell our, obviously we just kind of told our family and close friends about it, everyone was kind of like, oh, okay, And that is about it, because I think people are not very educated on it. I wasn't super educated on it until we started doing the research about it online, and we decided that that was the route we, you know, needed to go if we wanted to have a natural child of our own. And so people are almost afraid to talk about it, but I don't think they're afraid. I think it's just they don't understand the process. They don't understand why necessarily. I mean, you ask some random person what IVF is, and they say, "What is that?" You know, and I say, "Well, in vitro fertilization," and they go, "Well, what's that?" Test tube baby, basically. You know, it comes down to the old test tube baby is you know, what people remember. And that's such an old age word in this, you know, so, today. But it's very not, I mean, it's very unknown, really. And it's a very small community of people. And there's not a lot of talk about it. And there's starting to be more and more, which I think is great. But there's not enough. There's not enough of a support system.
Angela, I see you shaking your head. What would you add to that?
We always want more support for our patients. You know, we have two social workers in our practice and we refer people, but it's very challenging. And one of our nurses started a support group that meets in the evenings that's been very well received. There are some national organizations that have some online support groups, but they're not very active and their meetings were somewhat irregular, so it would never be the same group of people coming together. And that's really key, I think, to bonding with women who have common issues, that are really struggling hard with this problem of trying to get pregnant. There's something called the Mind Body Seminar Series. We work with another social worker, and it's a series of visits with a group of women where it provides that support. And actually, there's data that says that, you know, participating in these groups and lowering your stress, and it actually can help increase pregnancy rates. Mm-hmm. So it is so important to recognize how mentally and emotionally taxing this process is. And I think when we initiate a course of treatment, it's a really good idea both to first educate and say, hey, let's talk about what this means and why this is not your fault, and let's understand the biology of what's going on. But then let's talk about the time. How much time is this going to take you? And let's have a plan. If somebody, the undefined, unplanned, I have no idea, is this going to work? You're throwing money at this problem. It's so hard, so anxiety producing. But if you say, okay, we're going to try this plan for 3 months, this is your expected outcome, and this plan for 3 months, you give somebody something to hang on to and hope for too, that some medical facts that can help.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jennifer, I'm going to give you the last word because we're coming, running up on out of time. But I did want you know, you mentioned the education piece, and Angela just kind of followed up with that. So if you could tell listeners, you know, just one thing in terms of how maybe even they might educate themselves when talking to people who've been through the scenario, or if they're thinking about it for themselves, you know, what's important to know?
Well, I think that definitely if they're having any concerns or questions, that they find somebody referred through whatever clinic they go to, if there's somebody, an advocate for the company that actually has gone through the process, and talk to them firsthand, ask the questions, because the doctors are wonderful, they're great, but not all of them have gone through what we have gone through, and going through it personally is so much different. And especially when you go through it, it's scary to go through the whole process to begin with. And then when you have a loss after that, and then you have to gear up to try to go through it again, I know a lot of people don't want to go through it a second time. They'll quit after the first. And so, excuse me, if you can find somebody to talk to firsthand who's been through it, it is so helpful. I wish that I had had somebody, and my husband and I are both trying to be those people for different doctors. So,
well, that's beautiful. And again, congratulations to
you
and your husband.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Angela. Angela Thayer with Seattle Reproductive Medicine. She's a fertility physician there, as well as Jennifer Lair, a mother, who's joined us for this conversation. And her website, the website for Seattle Fertility, is seattlefertility.com. We'll have resources at our website, kbcs.fm, so you can find out more information there.